Moab. Remember why? What was Moab's sin? Remember the pride of Moab. It was the pride that was going to create their downfall. And today in chapter 17 of Isaiah, it begins the burden against Damascus. Now, Damascus is probably the oldest continually populated city in the world. It dates back at least 5,000 years ago. How many have heard of Titus Flavius Josephus? Josephus was a very, very early Roman Jewish historian. He lived from about 37 AD to around 100 AD. So he was right after Christ. And he wrote this whole history of the church. And one of the things he says in his history is that Damascus was founded by Uz. Yeah. And now Uz, who was Uz? The son of Aram. Who was Aram? The son of Shem. And who was Shem? The son of Noah. So Uz, who founded Damascus, was the great-grandson of Noah. It goes way back. Genesis chapter 14 is where we first get a mention of Damascus. And it's then mentioned 67 more times in the Bible. Damascus is talked about all the time. And a very, very important thing happened on the road to Damascus. What was that? Paul's conversion happened on the road to Damascus. He was met right there by Jesus Christ. And Christ blinded him and sent him on into town and says, you need to go see Ananias. And why was Paul going to Damascus? To persecute the Christians. And he has this encounter that changes not only his life, but it changes the world. Because he becomes an apostle for Christ. And look how many books in the Bible were written by Paul because of his experience on the road to Damascus. So Damascus today is the capital of Syria. Now, this is the best map I could find, and you have to bear with me. Damascus is way up here. I say best because it's the only one that has everything I wanted on it. Here's Damascus way up there. Now, just to give you an idea, here's Jerusalem right here. Okay, the Salt Sea is the Dead Sea, but Damascus is way up there. It's the capital of Syria. Okay, it is the heart of terrorism today. Okay, the Syrians are just not crazy about the rest of the world. It's about 85% Sunni Muslim. 85%. And about 10% Christian. So that leaves you 5% to have all the rest of the religions of the world in Damascus. So Isaiah starts out by saying the burden against Damascus. What is it that God has in store for Damascus? Behold, Damascus will cease from being a city, and it will be a ruinous heap. The cities of Aroer are forsaken. They will be for flocks which lie down, and no one will make them afraid. The fortress also will cease from Ephraim, the kingdom from Damascus, the remnant from Syria, and they will be as the glory of the children of Israel, says the Lord of hosts. Now let's do a little geography. Aroer is right here in the heart of Moab. Okay? So God is saying whatever's happening with Damascus, Jordan is going to be affected by it. This is Jordan today. Here's Ephraim. This is the land of Ephraim. The city of Ephraim is just below Shiloh. Okay? Did I get everything? Damascus. And of course, Syria is all this area up here now. All right. So that'll kind of give you an idea of what's going to happen. Now, he says that Damascus will cease from being a city, and it will be a ruinous heap. It is going to get wiped out. Now, it's been attacked several times in history. Tilgath-Pileser, another one of those great names. Where's Elizabeth? You could have named your kid Tilgath. Okay, he was a king of Syria, of Assyria, not Syria, but Assyria, an Assyrian king. Remember, we talked about Sargon, the Assyrian king, last week who wiped out Moab. A few years later, Tilgath-Pileser is now king, and he comes down and he wipes out Damascus. And then it gets wiped out again by Nebuchadnezzar. And then it wipes out again by Alexander the Great around 300 BC. But each time it comes back. So it still exists, even though it's been attacked and been pretty well crumbled. It didn't cease being a city. So in my study this week, I found several places that said that, oh, it was Tilgath-Pileser that wiped out Damascus and that prophecy has thus been fulfilled. But then I found others that said, every time it got wiped out, it got rebuilt. So it has not ceased being a city. And there's some really interesting prophecies that camp makes interpretations, I should say. And we'll talk about those as we go along. So we have Damascus ceasing from being a city. And the cities of Aroer are forsaken. Remember, that's down here in Jordan. So whatever happens to Damascus, Jordan is getting sucked into it there too. And they will be for flocks which lie down and no one will make them afraid. The sheep and the goats can just run through the streets because there's nobody left to startle them. There's nobody left to chase them off. And they'll have the run of the ruins. The fortresses also will cease from Ephraim. So what is happening in Ephraim here, those fortresses are also getting knocked down. So you see, this is a pretty broad area that's getting involved here. The kingdom from Damascus, the governance will be gone. They will remove all semblance of kingdom and governance from Damascus. Syria will be looking for another place to get run from, to be operated from. And they will be as the glory of the children of Israel. Israel has fallen, and so has Damascus. Neither one of them are going to have any glory, is what that's saying. So says the Lord. Now, this Ephraim, by the way, is This is the West Bank of Palestine today. You know, and you know what an uproarious place the left bank is. Okay? So we're going to get all this stuff involved in these interpretations of how this prophecy is going to get fulfilled. Verse 4, in that day, and that's the day that Damascus is destroyed, it shall come to pass that the glory of Jacob will wane. Now, who is Jacob? When we talk of Jacob here, we're talking about Israel. So Isaiah has made a shift from Damascus and into talking about Israel now. The glory of Israel will wane, and the fatness of his flesh will grow lean. It shall be as when the harvester gathers the grain and reaps the heads with his arm. It shall be as he who gathers heads of grain in the valley of Rephaim. Now, the valley of Rephaim, you'll remember, was where David fought the Philistines twice and was successful as king, twice beat the Philistines there. Now, the harvester gathers grains with his arm. When they harvested the grain in these ancient times, they had the scythe and they would hold it and cut it into sheaves, okay? So they're using their arm. They would stack those sheaves up then to let them dry a little bit so that they would have to cut them before the grain heads were ripe so that as those sheaves were formed, they didn't lose any of the product. None of the produce got knocked off. So they had to time it just right, and then they would continue to mature as they sat in those sheaves. And they would come back and take those sheaves to the threshing house. And in the threshing house, they would knock those off. And sometimes mostly they could get them by shaking, but sometimes they had to kind of knock them in, you know, with a stick. Kind of like the Lord has to do with me sometimes to get my attention and knock me in the head with a stick. So it will be like that. Everything is just going to be gathered up. Yet gleaning grapes will be left in it, like the shaking of an olive tree, two or three olives at the top of the uppermost bough, four or five in its most fruitful branches, says the Lord God of Israel. So as Israel is getting shaken up, there's going to be a few elect, a few people who are going to stand strong and be firm like the two or three olives at the top of the uppermost branches. When they harvested olives, they used a big stick and they actually beat the branches, okay, or shook them. Sometimes they would shake the whole tree. Nowadays, they use a machine, especially like in the almonds. If you ever go into the almond orchards, they have these huge machines. They have this like inverted umbrella they wrap around the trunk, and then this machine just sits there and shakes that tree. and all those almonds fall off. And they've been working that with olives as well, but it started out in the almond fields. My little brother used to work in the almonds in Northern California, and he used to tell me a story about these people on the bus, and this little old lady kept giving the bus driver these handfuls of almonds. And it would be a few minutes would go by, and she'd give him another handful of almonds. Finally, he turned around and says, "How come you're not eating the almonds?" He says, "Oh, I only like the chocolate on the outside." It's hard to find a good almond joke. You know what I mean? Yeah. I keep looking, right, Nancy? Keep looking. All right. So there's going to be a few faithful people that aren't going to be mown down. But for the most part, they're all getting taken away. So verse 7, "In that day, a man will look to his maker, and his eyes will have respect for the Holy One of Israel." Look what it took to get Israel to turn its eyes to its maker. What will it take to get us to turn our eyes to our maker? On that day, a man will look to his maker. We always wait till the calamity, till the tougher times, and then, when all else, we've tried it ourselves and we can't do it on our own, that's when we finally say, "Well, maybe I should turn to the Lord." And boy, wouldn't it just be easier if we turned to Him way before that, before we got into that calamitous, uncertain, horrid circumstance, if we would just think, and go where we know we need to go. I mean, I think about where this country is headed. What's it going to take to get this country to turn its eyes to its maker? Because this country was founded on Christian principles. And to let anybody tell you otherwise, that is absolutely the truth. But in that day, a man will look to his maker, and his eyes will have respect for the Holy One of Israel. He will not look to the altars, the works of his hands. He will not respect what his fingers have made, nor the wooden images, nor the incense altars. This time Israel has got so many other idols and so many other gods that they're looking to. These wooden images are made to Ashtoreth, who was the moon goddess of fertility and sexuality. And a lot of people turned to Ashtoreth. That was another one of Solomon's big doings when he fell away. Ashtoreth was one of the gods that he also brought into Israel. Verse 9, "In that day his strong cities will be as a forsaken bough and an uppermost branch which they left because of the children of Israel, and there will be desolation." And why? Verse 10, "Because you have forgotten the God of your salvation." All this comes, all this destruction, all this calamity, all this horrid circumstance comes because you have forgotten the God of your salvation. "And you have not been mindful of the rock of your stronghold." Who's the rock of your stronghold? Who's the rock? Do you consciously think of Christ as your rock, as your anchor, as your place of refuge in times of trouble? Where do you get your strength? "Therefore you will plant pleasant plants and set out foreign seedlings. And in the day you will make your plant to grow. And in the morning you will make your seed to flourish, but the harvest will be a heap of ruins in the day of grief and desperate sorrow." So you can try all you want to do it on your own. You can get those plants going. You can nurse those seedlings. You can water them. You can give them all the fertilizer they need. But in the end, the harvest will be a heap of ruins in the day of grief and the desperate sorrow if you forget the God of your salvation. Verse 12, "Woe to the multitude of many people who make a noise like the roar of seas, and to the rushing of nations that make a rushing like the rushing of mighty waters. The nations will rush like the rushing of many waters, but God will rebuke them, and they will flee far away, and be chased like the chaff of the mountains before the wind, like a rolling thing before the whirlwind." Now that rolling thing is also translated probably more accurately as thistle down, as a winged seed, like a dandelion. When you blow the dandelion, all those little thistle downs go taken off. Okay. Now, here's some interesting stuff here. You got one camp that says when Tilgath-Pileser took over Damascus, it fulfilled this prophecy. Now that happens in 2 Kings. Let's look at 2 Kings just so we get a good feeling for that. Chapter 19 of 2 Kings. And we'll start with verse 4. Tilgath-Pileser has got Jerusalem surrounded, in siege. He's sitting on Mount Copus. And he's got all of his soldiers up there. And Hezekiah is a little bit nervous about all that. So it may be that your Lord, your God, will hear from the words of Rabshakeh, from his master, the king of Assyria, has sent to reproach the living God, and will rebuke the words which the Lord your God has heard. Therefore, lift up your prayer for the remnant that is left. And so the servants of King Hezekiah came to Isaiah. So Isaiah was there. And Isaiah said to them, thus you shall say to your master, thus says the Lord, do not be afraid of the words which you have heard, with which the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. So Hezekiah's men are coming and saying, you know, Rabshakeh's got all this stuff and it's not looking too good. You know, things are really looking bad. They're talking bad about you, talking bad about us. They're going to wipe us out. And they said, well, go get Isaiah and let's see what Isaiah has to say. And Isaiah is saying, this is what God says. Isaiah's not saying, this is what I say. He's saying, this is what God says. Don't be afraid of the words you've heard that the servants of the king of Assyria have used to blaspheme me. Now, how many times do we get fearful of things we hear about us, about our family, about our church, about Christianity? We get fearful of that. And God says, don't be afraid of the words that you heard when people blaspheme me, because we know the truth. He says, surely I will send a spirit upon him, upon the king of Assyria, and he shall hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. And then the Rabshakeh returned and found the king of Assyria warring against Libna, for he heard that he had departed from Lachish. Now let's just quickly turn over to verse 35, because this is where it gets good. This is like the epic movie, the Charles B. DeMille's could be made right here. And it came to pass on a certain night that the angel of the Lord went out and killed in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when people arose early in the morning, there were the corpses, all dead. Wham! 185,000 overnight. Now, when we go back over to Isaiah, woe to the multitude of many people who make a noise like the roar of the seas, and to the rushing of nations that make a rushing like the rushing of mighty waters. One camp says that that's the sound of the Assyrian army marching like rushing waters. They're coming for Jerusalem. But God will rebuke them, and they will flee far away and be chased like the chaff off the mountains before the wind. And that's where the angel of the Lord comes in and wipes out 185,000 soldiers in one night. Like a rolling thing before the wind, he just whacks them. Could be. The other camp says that with all that's going on with Damascus, Syria, Jordan, the West Bank of Palestine, all the terrorism that's going on, that Damascus is going to launch an attack on Jerusalem. And Jerusalem, who has nuclear weapons today, is going to respond with a nuclear attack. Anybody ever heard of the Samson option? It's kind of interesting. The Samson option basically says that you have nuclear weapons, and because you're a small country, and it would take too long to organize your army, it would take 2 or 3 days to respond conventionally, that you wham them with a nuclear bomb so that they know you mean business. Okay. And people say that that's what's going to happen, that Damascus is going to attack Jerusalem, and that Jerusalem, Israel, will respond with a nuclear attack. And that's going to wipe out all of this area that we're talking about. And then the world is going to go, Israel, what are you thinking? That was stupid. And that rushing of the nations is the rest of the world spanking Israel, okay, saying, you know, that you were wrong, you know, and all kinds of sanctions and things that go along. So you have two different camps here. Now, if we look at verse 14, and then behold, at eventide, trouble, and before the morning, he is no more. One camp says, in the morning, all those soldiers were sitting up there on Mount Copus, and they were surrounding, laying siege to Jerusalem, and there was trouble. But in the morning, they were no more. That the angel of the Lord wiped them out, 185,000 dead soldiers. The other camp says, in the evening, there's trouble. Damascus attacks. And in the morning, Israel drops the bomb and wipes out Damascus. And now Damascus is ceased to be a city. It is laying in ruins. So there's two different interpretations out there. It was pretty interesting. If you have a spare hour, you know, and you have the internet, just look at Isaiah chapter 17, Damascus. Put that into your Google search, and you'll get all kinds of commentaries about these last day predictions of how Isaiah, how that prophecy has or has not been fulfilled. Pretty interesting stuff. For this is the portion of those who plunder us, and the lot of those who rob us. It's going to be gone in the morning. So don't mess with Israel. Okay. Now, verse 8, chapter 18. Chapter 18 has been called one of the oddest chapters in the whole Bible in trying to interpret it. This land shadowed with buzzed wings. You know, I read someplace, oh, that buzzed wings, that's airplanes. Okay, you know. And others that say, well, that's the jungles of Ethiopia, because this chapter is talking about Ethiopia. Now, Ethiopia and Assyria were enemies. Okay? Ethiopia is down below Egypt, and Assyria is above Syria. It's farther north, okay, and a little bit more to the east. Now, both of those kingdoms are built around rivers. Assyria built around the Euphrates. Ethiopia built around the Nile, the Blue Nile specifically. Blue Nile, White Nile come together to form the Nile and then go up through Egypt. And with the waters of these major rivers, you have commerce, you have produce, you have agriculture, you have power and strength that derives because of the position on these rivers. So Assyria and Ethiopia are enemies. And if you remember one time, a couple of times, Ethiopia comes to the rescue of Israel against Assyria. So Ethiopia is not exactly an ally, but they have allied from time to time. And it appears as though this chapter, and when we get into it, you'll see what I'm saying, is talking about Tilgath-Pileser's defeat, that we're going to go and tell Ethiopia because they're going to want to know. So let's a little bit of background there. Woe to the land shadowed with buzzing wings, which is beyond the rivers of Ethiopia. That's the jungle bugs and things. Which sends ambassadors by sea, even in vessels of reed on the waters. Now, they use the word sea, but they're talking about the Nile. Okay, these vessels of reed were a papyrus boat. They called them tankwas. And the Ethiopians were known for those. They're two- or three-man boats. They're relatively small. And they basically are bundles of reed. They have an acacia wood keel on them. And they're actually quite quick. Job makes a mention of swift boats that is probably referring to these Ethiopian tankwas. They're light enough that, you know, if the waters are low and you can't pull your way through it, you can just throw it over your back and walk on down. It's a very, very light and very, very quick boat. So these bulrush vessels, they're not seaworthy. So that's one of the reasons that they're sure that the seas is actually the Nile. So they're sending ambassadors down the Nile saying, go swift messengers to a nation tall and smooth of skin, to a people terrible from their beginning onward, a nation powerful and treading down, whose land the rivers divide. Go and tell them that the Assyrians got wiped out. They got spanked. 185,000 of them are dead, because Ethiopia's going to want to know that. Now, this nation, tall and smooth of skin, has been also translated a number of ways. Sleek seems to be a more accurate description from all that I read. And of course, the land the rivers divide, that's the Blue Nile, the White Nile, and carrying silt and stuff down into the main Nile, making the lands more and more fertile. Verse 3, all inhabitants of the world and dwellers on the earth, when he lifts up a banner on the mountains, you see it, and when he blows a trumpet, you hear it. For so the Lord said to me, I will take my rest, and I will look for my dwelling place, like clear heat and sunshine, like a cloud of dew in the heat of harvest. For before the harvest, when the bud is perfect and the sour grape is ripening in the flower, he will both cut off the sprigs with pruning hooks and take away and cut down the branches. So this is the message that they're taking back to Ethiopia, that, you know, Tilgath-Pileser is up there blasting about how cool he is, you know, honking his horns and flashing his banners. And the Lord's just saying, you know, I'm going to take my rest. I don't even need to deal with this, okay? I'll just look down from my dwelling place like clear heat and sunshine and a cloud of dew in the heat of harvest. Those aren't good things. When you have clear heat, in sunshine, that's going to burn your herbs. It's going to burn your plants. You don't need that clear heat, okay? And the cloud of dew in the heat of harvest, when you're right there ready to ripe, ready to harvest and things are ripe, you don't want them to get wet. It'll rot the fruit. It'll spoil it. So these aren't good things. The Lord is saying, I'm going to look down there. For before the harvest, when the bud is perfect, and Tilgath-Pileser thinking his bud is coming up, right? He's on the rise. And the sour grape is ripening in the flower, that the juices are getting their sugars going and they're ripening up. Oh, look at that. He will cut off the sprigs and the pruning hooks and take away and cut down the branches. Just when old Tilgath-Pileser thinks it's all going to be good, wham, he gets cut right down. Sprig, buds, all that. Pruning hooks are just cutting the branches down just at the drop of his word. And the angel comes and wipes out 185,000 of them. And they'll be left together for the mountain birds of prey and the beasts of the earth. All those carcasses, 185,000 dead soldiers laying out there for the beasts of the earth and the birds of prey. The birds of prey will summer on them and the beasts of the earth will winter on them. They've got more than a year's worth of food there. There's plenty for those scavengers. And in that time, a present will be brought to the Lord of hosts from a people tall and smooth of skin and from a people terrible from their beginning onward, a nation powerful and treading down and whose land the rivers divide to the place of the name of the Lord of hosts, to Mount Zion. Now, there's a lot of different thoughts about what that present is. Most think that that present is Ethiopia itself. If we look at Psalms, verse 68, chapter 68, verse 31, it says, envoys will come out of Egypt and Ethiopia will quickly stretch out her hands to God. And if you remember in Acts, let's go over to Acts chapter 8. We want to look at chapter 8, verse 26. Now an angel of the Lord spoke to Philip, saying, arise and go toward the south along the road which goes down from Jerusalem to Gaza. This is desert. And so he arose and went. And he beheld, and behold, a man of Ethiopia, a eunuch of great authority under Candace, the queen of the Ethiopians, who had charge of all her treasury and had come to Jerusalem to worship, was returning. And sitting in the chariot, he was reading Isaiah, the prophet. Then the Spirit said to Philip, go near and overtake this chariot. So Philip ran to him and heard him reading the prophet Isaiah and said, do you understand what you're reading? And he said, how can I, unless someone guides me? And he asked Philip to come up and sit with him. And the place in the scriptures which he read was, he was led as a sheep to the slaughter, and as a lamb before its shearer is silent, so he opened not his mouth. In his humiliation, his justice was taken away. And who will declare his generation? For his life is taken from the earth. And so the eunuch answered Philip and said, I ask you, Of whom does this prophet say this? Of himself or of some other man? This was a prophecy that Isaiah made, and we're going to get to it soon. Then Philip opened his mouth, and beginning at this scripture, he preached Jesus to him. Now as they went down the road, they came to some water, and the eunuch said, "See, here is water. What hinders me from being baptized?" Then Philip said, "If you believe with all your heart, you may." And he answered and said, "I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God." So he commanded the chariot to stand still, and both Philip and the eunuch went down into the waters, and he baptized them. And when they came up out of the water, the Spirit of the Lord caught Philip away, so that the eunuch saw him no more, and he went on his way rejoicing. So Isaiah is used again many, many years later to bring salvation or instigate salvation in this Ethiopian man. And people say that that's the beginning of this present. Ethiopia as a nation will come to Christ as a result of this prophecy. Isn't it interesting how this Ethiopian was reading Isaiah? And here's Isaiah saying that Ethiopia is going to bring a present to the Lord. But the eunuch recognized that he needed to be baptized. And he could only be baptized if he believed that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And he did. And so I ask you this morning, do you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? And have you been baptized? If not, talk to me or talk to Pastor Roger when he gets back, and we'll make sure that happens. So, even the Old Testament speaks of Christ. Even the Old Testament is there to lead us to the rock, to lead us so that we don't, as Isaiah say, forget. How was the, what was the wording here? We don't forget the God of our salvation. Because that's what happened to Israel. Moab, it was all about pride. But here Israel forgets the God of their salvation. And they're not mindful of the rock of their stronghold. We need to be mindful of our rock. That's Isaiah 17 and 18. Do look up Damascus in the last days.